Our next talk is by Yossi Gelfand. He's going to tell us about probing extreme physics with pulsar wind nebulae.
Thank you very much. So I'm going to be presenting work here done with a lot of collaborators, many of whom are in the room. So as Taya very nicely described yesterday, there's lots of different ingredients that go into producing a pulsar wind nebula and understanding its evolution, which relate to lots of interesting physics. So the pulsar wind nebula is powered by the rotational energy of the pulsar. Its properties are going to depend on how much energy has been injected. That in turn depends on, well, what's the total energy of the pulsar that it can inject, relates to the initial spin period, which is from the core collapse supernova, and how quickly is this energy injected into the pulsar wind nebula, which relates to the spin down timescale and breaking index. The properties of the pulsar wind nebula will also depend on, well, what is this pulsar wind? How much of that energy is a magnetic field? How many particles does it have, and what's the particle spectrum? And lastly, it's not expanding into a vacuum, which is why we detect it. It's expanding inside a supernova remnant, and as Taya described yesterday, its evolution is sensitive to the properties of, or the conditions inside the supernova remnant, which depend on the mass and initial kinetic energy of the supernova ejecta, and also the density of the surrounding ISM, which regulates the reverse shock collision. So the properties of this pulsar wind nebula depend on all of these interesting physical characteristics we'd like to understand. What we'd like is a way of deriving these from the observed properties of a pulsar wind nebula, and that requires a model. So what is this model? Well, it's essentially Reynolds and Chevalier in 1984. It's a one-zone model, so going to be assuming a uniform ISM in a uniform pulsar wind nebula. So uniform magnetic field strength within, uniform distribution of particles. The dynamical evolution of the pulsar wind nebula is determined by the motion of the swept up ejecta around it. There's some pressure inside the pulsar wind nebula that exerts an outward force. There's some pressure outside the pulsar wind nebula that exerts an inward force. Different pressure, you have a net force, F equals dp dt. You can give it to an undergrad to solve. I've done that on problem sets before. They can do it most of the time. Now, what you also need to account for the dynamical evolution and what we see is the emission processes. Now, the nice thing is that this pulsar wind is just an electron-positron plasma. No ions complicating the emission mechanism, so it's pretty much synchrotron and inverse Compton emission, which is fairly easy to calculate. So we have this model. What do we do? So the model calculates the volume integrated properties of the pulsar wind nebula. So we compare it to the volume integrated properties of the pulsar wind nebula using the spin down age and characteristic age of the pulsar. And we also try to reproduce the size of the supernova remnant because we do include the evolution of the supernova remnant in the model. We identify different combinations of the input parameters that reproduce the observables. Now, there's significant degeneracies between them, so we'll see a few plots like this. Here I've plotted the trial values of the distance versus wind magnetization. The color indicates the chi-squared or quality of fit. Higher chi-squared, black or blue. Better fit, lower chi-squared, red. We see significant degeneracies, which is important in trying to interpret the results. So the first question is, does this work? So I applied it to an initial sample. This pretty source G11.2, very good chi-squared, few degrees of freedom, reduced chi-squared less than 1, that's great. Another source G21.5 minus 0.9. By eye, the SCD looks like to be a great fit, but it's actually this one last low-frequency radio point here where it deviates, and that explains pretty much this entire chi-squared. G54.1 plus 0.3, very nice fit, but no degrees of freedom. I'll come back to that in a little bit. Another source, Hess J1640, good fit. KESS75, which we've heard about a bit, good fit, but again, no degrees of freedom, so anything would give a good fit. Lastly, MSH15-52. The model reproduces the SCD really well. Can't show you these points because it's blacked out by the Fermi collaboration, but it doesn't reproduce the size, which is why it has a large chi-squared. They're working on it, but it fits, believe me. Now, there are about 20 suitable pulsar wind nebula which we can apply this analysis to, so have a reasonable sample. But one thing I mentioned before is for a lot of these systems, we don't have many degrees of freedom. So any model should work. Why would you believe these results? Well, the nice thing about doing this parameter search is you can predict the results of future observations. So for G54.1 plus 0.3, I was doing this just as LOFAR was starting. So I asked, what should the 60 and 150 megahertz flux densities of this pulsar wind nebula be? Here's the range of predictions. It actually is very sensitive to the initial spin period. LOFAR did an all-sky survey. It measured 0.3 plus or minus 0.1 Janskis within the range of my predictions, which suggests an initial spin period of 65 milliseconds. Okay, that's great. Low frequency radio, lowest energy particles, it should, model would work, but it's not, you know, how about higher energies where synchrotron losses are more important? So NuSTAR was about to launch, also predicted the 5 to 80K EV flux. This flux is actually highly dependent with the distance in my model. Got a NuSTAR observation, again consistent with what we saw, and applies a distance of 4.5 to 5 kiloparsecs. Now in my model, the initial spin period depends on the distance. So I have an additional constraint, and I have an additional constraint on the NuSTAR distance. And in the modeling I had done before either of these observations, I got plenty of trials with good chi-squares at the intersection. So these two predictions from very different parts of the electromagnetic spectrum are reproduced by the model, and they're even consistent with each other. So maybe this spherical Cowell model actually has something real to say for pulsar wind nebulae. So what happens when we look at the results of a sample? So in the first few days of this conference, we heard a lot about supernova explosions. So what are the super properties, the derived properties of these supernovae? So if you notice, for three of them, it's very low energy explosions, so a few times 10 to the 50 ergs or less, and high ejecta masses. Now this is consistent with some of the latest, the explosion energies are consistent with some of the latest simulations. But these high ejecta masses often form black holes in these systems due to fallback. These have pulsars, so there's a neutron star. So the simulations have to have minimal fallback in these regimes. Now for two of these, the model requires a very low ISM density to get the right size of the supernova remnant. That suggests that maybe there are pulsar wind nebulae in regions inside a stellar wind bubble. As Taya said yesterday, for G54.1, we see those massive stars in the IR, and we might actually see them around this source as well. And for two of these systems, in order to get it to work, you require very low ejecta mass, which suggests either a Wolf-Rayet or more likely a binary progenitor. You had a lot of mass transfer in the late stages before the star blew up. And as Nathan Smith said, 70% of binary stars are likely in, or sorry, 70% of massive stars are in binaries. So you would expect some of these pulsar wind nebulae to be in binary progenitors. Now, in the case of the single star progenitors, you can use the ejecta mass to estimate the progenitor mass. For G11.2, it's somewhere between 10 and 30. G21.5, a little higher. Taya discussed G54.1 yesterday. And for MSH15-52, which had a lower ejecta mass, you only get that if the progenitor was very massive, so 60 solar masses or so. So one thing can look at is we have some estimates on the supernova and progenitor properties of these pulsars. Does it relate to the pulsar properties themselves? So this is the same list that I did before. I just ordered it in terms of the spin down inferred dipole surface magnetic field strength. It's a mouthful. What you might notice is that the lowest three, which admittedly span from 2 times 10 to the 12 to 10 to the 13th Gauss, are all the low energy, high ejecta mass explosions. The pulsars that either have a binary progenitor or a high mass progenitor seem to have stronger magnetic field strengths. Now, this is a sample of six, but this suggests, is there some dependence between the pulsar magnetic field strength in either the progenitor star or the progenitor supernova, which offers some insight into how these stars explode. Additionally, what you get out of the explosion isn't just the magnetic field strength, but the initial spin period. That could be conservation of the core's angular momentum. It could be determined by fallback of material onto the proto-neutron star, and in which case one model predicts a relationship between the initial spin period and the magnetic field strength. So we can test this. So again, this is the same list ordered by magnetic field strength. Here are the initial spin periods we get from modeling just the pulsar wind nebula. The range from 20 to 200 milliseconds is similar to what's been produced in some of the latest supernova explosion models. You might notice that for this high mass, for this magnetar-like pulsar, it's 200 milliseconds, not 2 milliseconds. And if you compare it to the projection of the fallback, the initial spin period magnetic field strength, you get reasonably good agreement. In addition, as Mari Len explained, there are particles accelerated to high energies in these pulsar wind nebula. And this modeling can provide insight in that process as well. Now, unlike the particle acceleration in supernova remnants, we have sort of a different situation here. The unshocked wind coming out of the pulsar that's being shocked and accelerated, it's primarily electron-positron, it's equatorial, it's magnetically striped, meaning they're regions of different magnetic field direction, and most of the energy is in magnetic fields. So a very different initial condition than you have in supernova shocks. Now, the confinement of the pulsar wind by the surroundings leads to this termination shock, where the wind is compressed and possibly you get magnetic reconnection. Now, when people do pig simulations, this particle spectrum they get out depends on the width of these strips. If it's thin, you get a Maxwellian. If it's thick, you get something that resembles a broken power law. When you model these systems, the injection spectrum you need is almost always a broken power law. In these models, they say magnetic reconnection dominates at low energies, P1 around 1.5. At Fermi acceleration at high energies, you should get a steeper index of 2.5. So what do we get from the modeling of these pulsar winds? So the first thing you might notice is low magnetization. So you do require very efficient conversion of magnetic to particle energy. The widths we can estimate for the ones with termination shocks are very narrow, not wide. So even though we get the broken power law spectrum of wide stripes in these simulations, the data suggests otherwise. In general, the P1 and P2 values agree with what's simulated, except for this source, G21.5, where P1's actually bigger than P2. You can also get out of these models the maximum particle energy. And sort of the conventional wisdom is that the maximum particle energy is limited by the voltage at the pulsar gap, so the pulsar voltage. The maximum particle energies is on the order of PEV, which is what you need to explain the GEV and TEV emission that Mari Len talked about. For this one system, G11.2, the maximum energy is actually most likely higher than the pulsar voltage, though in the other cases, it's less. So to summarize, before Pat boots me off the stage, have a very simple model for the evolution of a pulsar wind nebula inside a supernova remnant. It actually, even though it's ridiculously simple, it does reproduce the observed properties of many systems, and it actually makes accurate predictions, which is not something I expected when I started this. We applied it to a small sample of pulsar wind nebulae. We do get pulsars from low energy, high mass explosions, which says something about how much fallback you can have during these supernovae. We find that maybe the magnetic field strength of the neutron star is correlated with the type of progenitor star or the supernova explosion. The initial spin periods we get are fairly consistent with fallback onto the proto-neutron star during the explosion. The particle spectrum is consistent with a mixture of magnetic reconnection and Fermi acceleration, with the maximum energy consistent with the pulsar voltage, with lots of weasel words and caveats here. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Yossi. Do we have questions? There's one over here, Steve.
Nice stuff. What do you assume for the ejecta structure in these models?
So what I assume is a constant ejecta density core and an r to the minus 9 envelope in all of these models. Okay. So this was what was done sort of originally. There could be nickel bubbles and things like that, but so far, this constant density core and r to the minus 9 envelope seems to reproduce all of them.
I think it's worth checking at least the nickel bubble effect, because it can still be done in 1D, and just see how much it tends to affect the result.
So,
Other questions? Right there.
Thank you for talk. Tell me, is there some particle nebula in the evaporation phase? What phase for the evaporation for all of them?
So in my modeling, none of these pulsar wind nebulae are in the reverberation phase. Now, since Steve is in the audience and he worked on G11.2, in their paper, they found that the pulsar wind nebulas collided with the reverse shock. So what we find for G11.2 is that this collision hasn't happened yet. Now, if you look at the Chandra image, there's this hard X-ray rim. And if you ask my model where the reverse shock should be, it actually corresponds with this hard X-ray rim. So for this pulsar wind nebula, at least my modeling suggests that the reverse shock hasn't collided with the pulsar wind nebula yet, and it's actually responsible for this sort of excess 8 keV inner shell that's seen in the Chandra. Now, my modeling doesn't assume free expansion reverberation or not. It just happens to be that the systems I've worked on, it hasn't required a reverse shock interaction to do these.
Yep, back there.
Hi. So all your supernova energies that you infer are relatively low. Do you think it's a sample effect, or?
So there is a possible selection bias in that when we detect these when we detect these pulsar wind nebulae, the detection is limited by surface brightness. So if you take two pulsars, same rotation energy, and inject them into different supernova explosions, one lower energy, one higher energy, the higher energy one is going to have a lower density ejecta core. Less material to confine the pulsar wind nebula, it grows faster, its surface brightness drops faster. So there very well might be a selection effect in terms of we preferentially detect bright pulsar wind nebula in low energy explosions. Now I've calculated, I've tested this using simulated between 10 to the 50 erg, 10 to the 51 ergs. The surface brightnesses you get should still be detectable by current surveys and things. So I think it's possible that it is a selection effect, but current surveys should detect these similar pulsars exploding in 10 to the 51 erg explosions. So maybe when I expand from 6 to 20, I'll get more of these. But yeah, I do notice it's a bit weird, not what I was expecting. I'm happy that for MSH15-52, it's 2 times 10 to the 51 ergs, because that suggests it isn't necessarily a bias in my model. And for G11.2, when Steve and people did an independent analysis of the X-ray, thermal X-ray emission, they actually got a similar explosion energy that I did just from the pulsar wind nebula. So for some of these systems, there's evidence that other evidence they were low energy explosions. My model favors that. And at least for one system, I don't require a low energy model, so I don't think, or low energy explosion, so I don't think my model requires that for all of them. But it is odd, and there might be a selection effect.
While that slide is up, the estimated values with the twiddles, about what is the percentage uncertainty based on the modeling?
So the difference between the twiddles and the ones with errors is how many trials I've done. So for the ones with errors, I've done like a million trials, and I actually have real error bars. Here I've only done, say, 10,000 or so. So these might vary by factors of a few. So I've done one, say, an order of magnitude higher and don't get as good of a fit, but I haven't done the full multi-dimensional parameter space that lets me put a sort of more secure limits on these, because there are lots of degeneracies.
Right, but so in particular, you were talking about the energies over here. So
oh.
When you say
So these energies, they're not 10 to the 51. These two here, I tried 10 to the 51 erg explosions.
I get it.
It didn't work at all. So for G54.1, it works, but then you have 80 solar masses of ejecta. For the ones with the tilde, I started at 10 to the 51 ergs. It didn't really work, but I haven't tried the full ranges of things for me to go. But for the ones with these, yeah, it's not 10 to the 51.
Got it. Any other questions?
Yes.
Oh, sorry, Reno.
So you have mentioned that the broken power law can be understood from modeling in terms of fixed stripes. And what about the prediction of the position of the break energy?
So the break energy, sorry, let me fast forward to, I have this in a backup slide. So the break energies I get are sort of on the order of a TeV.
But is it constant? It has any dependence on the maximum potential drop, or in that case, it should be constant or following any other kind of law?
So here is the plot with the pulsar potential drop and the break energies. I didn't make the plot, but looking at this, I don't see an obvious trend.
Yes. But so the model does not predict any special kind of behavior.
So my model doesn't predict anything. When I apply my model to systems, I don't find a correlation between the pulsar drop and the break energy. And I'm trying to be specific,
Thank you.
Sorry.
Actually, a related question. So the potential drop, it's associated with the energy gain that you get from reconnection. So in principle, that estimate that goes up to a PEV should come from the potential drop. The fact that you have the two-step process, reconnection plus Fermi acceleration, basically invalidates the prediction for the maximum energy. Because shock acceleration could produce anything else.
I agree with you 100%. The reason why I mention it was I once got into a long discussion with a collaborator who's not here, who argued that there's no way you can get a maximum energy bigger than the potential drop. And I said, but it's shock acceleration, you can. I put it here just as a comparison. I agree with you that the maximum energy shouldn't necessarily be limited by this.
But related to this, what is the role of losses, of synchrotron losses? Do you account for loss for a steepening due to synchrotron losses, and can it induce the break?
So in my model, let me just go back to, I account for synchrotron losses and I account for radiative losses, synchrotron and inverse Compton losses over the age of the pulsar wind nebula in the SCD. So what you actually find in the SCD, since you have continuous injection and continuous losses, is that you don't necessarily get a sharp break. You get sort of a gentle curvature in the spectrum. Now, when I reproduce it with data, what that would result is essentially if Chandra measures from 0.5 to 10 keV, it gets one photon index. If Neustar measures from 5 to 25 keV or something, you get a different photon index. And when fitting the SCD, I require my model to reproduce both. So you do get magnetic field strengths. You do see the effect of synchrotron cooling. Now, at these late times, the synchrotron lifetime of the X-ray emitting particles is actually much longer than the age of the pulsar wind nebula, because the magnetic field strengths are so slow. So that's more of an issue at early times than late times, but it is something that I model and account for.
Okay, thanks. We're going to need to move on from the speaker. Thanks. Let's thank Yossi again.